Good morning, everyone. It's such a pleasure to see you this morning. We are in the second part of a three-part series, Bending the Moral Arc Toward Justice in the Season of Juneteenth. And we're so glad you're with us. Today, we have Andre Thomas, who has been working for IELTS for more than two decades, and he's a very good friend of mine, so it's wonderful to have him here. And I will introduce him in a moment. But first, let's pray. Please pray with me. Gracious God, we give thanks for this lovely morning. We are grateful for our speaker and for our friends here today. We ask that you open our hearts and minds as we learn about doing justice on a daily basis. May we draw nearer to you as we learn. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. Andre Thomas began working at the IELTS Youth Institute in 2001 as the operations manager. He is currently the senior training manager at IELTS, where he trains contractors in lead-safe renovations and energy-efficient practices. He and his father, Calvin Thomas, manage a youth leadership program called Healthy Relationship Choices in partnership with the Father Center of New Jersey. He is also the life skills coach at the Trenton Circus. Andre, is that Circus Squad? I was going to say, Trenton has a circus again? How cool is that? Andre takes advantage of every opportunity to use his skills and networks to assist people in his community and beyond. Please give a warm welcome to Andre Thomas.
Good morning. And I would like to title my presentation, The Gift of Transformation. Andre Thomas grew up in the city of Trenton, born and raised. And I grew up in a single family household, but my dad was involved. My parents had me when they were young. And that poses significant challenges. Although I had a very good support system. I had a supportive grandmother who I lost early. On my mother's side, and also a supportive grandmother on my dad's side. And they were significant because my parents were young when they had me. And things were going well, right? I grew up normal, pretty. I was the only child for a while before my sisters came into play. And I would say I had a pretty good childhood. And then played baseball, Little League baseball. I was a big sports fan. Matter of fact, one of my coaches in Little League was the former mayor for Trenton, Doug Palmer. And every time we see each other, we talk about those days. And so things were well. And I didn't see any challenges in my life till I got to ninth grade. Ninth grade is when life started happening, right? Middle school, my friends became more important, right? And I think... the household started to feel the weight of a single family household as I got older, because again, you make choices, right? And I chose my friends, which is a normal function, at the time though, Trenton started facing significant challenges as I became a teenager. Drugs flooded our neighborhoods, concentrated poverty was real. I didn't realize it at the time, as I reflect, the history of Trenton. The 80s is when it all kind of, after white flight and significant exodus from Trenton, it posed a lot of challenges. Trenton became a hood of concentrated poverty. And I didn't understand it then, but as I reflect back, I saw that, okay, things were there for you to grab onto. And as I was a teenager and seeing my mother began to struggle because she went through a marriage that failed, and I started to see her struggle. I would hear her cry, trying to make ends meet. My dad was off in the military, so still learning how to, try to wring me back in, because I started to sway a little bit. I started getting involved with the streets. And at the time, my young mind couldn't see the consequences, right? I thought it was the thing to do. I had a lot of family members that were older and influential in my life. And because I was living in a single parent household, my mother would go to work, and after school, I was unsupervised. To a young mind with all these temptations, it's a recipe for disaster, right? And so I got involved in the streets before my mother and dad even knew how deeply I got involved. Before they knew, I finally caught a charge, and they was like, oh my goodness, you're getting in trouble. So I was really running circles around my dad and my mom when I was younger, you know. But, you know, I realized when my mother had ran into the love of her life, and they got married, and they're still together. We just celebrated, I forget how many years. They've been together since forever. But Larry Ganges, who was my stepfather, I remember him coming into my mother's life, and my mother had daughters, and he embraced them, and I was the wild card, right? I was the out-of-control teenager that, you know, I know he was like, you know, Brenda, you know, this guy here, you know, and I understood, you know, I didn't understand then, but I understood now his challenge with me. So I kind of was still running roughshod with my parents, and it became all about the streets, but I would kind of, you know, run circles around them and make them think I was doing other things, although I was knee deep into the streets. So I ended up dropping out of school. And the reason why that was significant is because I wasn't gifted and talented growing up. I was a smart kid, but, you know, temptation got the best of me. And so I was struggling in high school. To be honest with you, I was not focused on school at this point. I had got a taste of the sugar, right? You know, my wife and I went to Dominican Republic some years ago when we got married, and we went on an excursion, and the guy talked about the sugar. He said, a lot of folks here in Dominican, don't feel sorry for us, because a lot of folks, this is all they know. But the ones that leave this country and get a taste of the sugar, you know, then it becomes like, wow, they began to understand, like, we're missing some things. So I got a taste of that sugar, meaning the street. And just to bring some clarity on that, it's like, you know, when you're preparing dinner for your kids and someone gives them ice cream before the meal, it ruins their appetite for the food that they need. So for me, the streets ruined my appetite for knowledge that I needed to build my foundation as an adult. That's how I reflect on the things the streets did to me. So I end up quitting school, and my dad, you know, he tried to shoot me some bell, use his military influence. He came to school with his uniform on and tried to talk to the guidance counselor. And he said, look, my son was gifted and talented, you know, and he worked it out with the guidance counselor. All I know is we walked out of there, I was going to the Navy. Pending graduation. So I had that weight on me, right? So my dad felt like, okay, I took care of that, I'm off. So now I'm struggling with, okay, I even went to Philadelphia. I had my picture. I'm going to the Great Lakes. It was all destined, pending the diploma. So at the time, I was struggling with that decision. I was torn, and I started to self-sabotage because I got involved with the streets. And, you know, with a young mind, a pocket full of money, you think, I'm good. And then I was watching a movie that influenced my decision, because I'm looking for an excuse to drop it. So I'm watching Officer and Gentleman. I'm sitting there, probably high off marijuana, pocket full of money, which was, you know, I use the term from Jay-Z, where he says, flash now, but time will reveal money. That was street money. You know, flash now, but time will reveal that it's not sustainable. But, you know, young mind, high, watching this movie. And the guy in the Navy thing was going in the water. And I couldn't swim because I cut swimming classes. So, problem. So the guy went in the water. He couldn't get out. And I'm looking. I'm like, see, I can't do this. What are they? See, I'm not built for this. So I self-sabotaged. And I made sure that I didn't graduate, which, you know, really made my mom upset. And so I said, look, Mom, I'm going to go get my GED, because me and my friend were smart, gifted in town. We went and got our GEDs the first time, back when it was a hard test. Got our GED. It was in 1987, the year I was supposed to graduate. And then I told my mother to keep her off my back, because I had developed a little slickness from the street, so it was all about manipulation. And as I discovered, with teenagers, that's a normal stage of development. We become manipulators, right? We gravitate to manipulation rather than genuine navigation, right? So you know, I said, Mom, I'm going to go to school. I'm going to go to college. I went to Mercer County for computer operations, right? You know, even though I wasn't really, you know, sold in on that plan, it was just an excuse to get them off my back. Because at this time, I'm selling drugs 100 miles an hour, and I'm justified. In my mind, my young mind, it was just a front for her, you know. So that didn't last long. And that's when, you know, we came to a head, end up leaving the house because my mother's like, look, you got to do something with your life. My dad was, you know, flabbergasted, not sure he wanted to do so. At that time, the streets was pretty good to me at the time. And so I moved out thinking I was okay. Got an apartment. And I tell you, at that point, it's when, you know, I started dealing with some of the consequences of my decision. And I started realizing that, you know. And the crazy part about it is, the surface, you would think that I was all good, because you know how to front. You know, I would hang out with my boys and it seemed all good. But at that time, I didn't know it then, but I know it now as I reflect. My purpose started pulling at me, because I was never comfortable with my street success. It's never comfortable. Even when I was okay and I was, you know, I was never comfortable. I was always struggling internally. But, you know, you bury those thoughts. You know, when your boys are around and the music is on and you have all these influences, you bury those thoughts. Matter of fact, you avoid the quiet because the quiet challenged you. So I avoided the quiet. So I stayed in noisy environments and ended up started catching charges, right? So now it started to come to a head because I'm catching charges. I caught my first charge. The minute I left my mom's house, I caught a charge and I was 18 years old and I was in Middlesex County with a $20,000 bail. And I realized, I said, wait a minute, this is not what I planned, because I was smart. So the knowledge is kicking in. I'm like, this is not good, but I'm knee deep. And so now I'm in this game and I'm trying to figure things out. So it was confusing. It was frustrating. And so what we do, we just front and we just kind of adjust and adapt. And eventually those charges came to a head. And I was sentenced to 15 years for nonviolent drug offenses. This was in the 90s. And I was really, that really threw me for a loop, because at that time I was like, man, this is serious. And the thing, my knowledge started kicking in. And I remember going to Bayside Prison, really like answering to that call, because now I had to deal with the quiet. I could no longer run. And it reminds me of sort of, I always use this analogy. It's like you make noise because you're afraid of what you might hear, what's going on in your head. And I saw that even happen in prison. A lot of guys would make a lot of noise. They talk about the past, and it was to avoid that quiet. It's like after watching a scary movie and walking through the graveyard. You know, you're afraid of what you might hear, so you make noise. And those are distractions. So at that point, my dad and I reconnected. He started sending me books, and I started reading these books, and light switches started going off for me. You know, I started reading books, My Name Akbar, Stephen Covey, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. I'm reading these books and even spiritual books. I'm reading the Bible. I'm reading different things, and light switches started going off. So I'm realizing, oh, I want to change my life. Now I had to deal with the reality of what I'm going to do with my life, you know, because now I'm in my 20s. I had to do 5 years before I came home, and it looked like a very challenging thing, because it gave me lots of fear, uncertainties, insecurities. But I knew it was like life was talking to me. God was talking to me. You either do it now or it's not going to happen. And I started to realize that I had to do some things in my life. So I came home, and the things I was reading, I started internalizing these principles, and I came home and I got on the path. And I think the biggest thing for me to really gather myself and come to myself, one, I had to really give a lot of praise to God, of course, and for using my dad to really, he was really patient with me. And I realized even the times I was in the street, he would pick me up and ride around and plant seeds. He didn't force it. He just kind of tried to give me some influence, give me some pointers. At the time, I didn't receive it well because I was thinking about the streets, but I realized that he was planting seeds. And when I was in prison, they started to take root. But I was like that bamboo seed. You know, I don't know if you guys know about bamboo, but it takes a long time for that seed to crack. And I was that hard seed. Matter of fact, they say bamboo seed, you can water it for 5 years and it won't crack. because it's a hard seed. It takes a patient gardener, water that seed, water that seed. And that was my dad for me. He was that patient gardener. Even when he knew I was getting in trouble, he knew that he could not force this behavior. So he just kind of let me know that he was here for me. But the thing about that bamboo seed is when it cracks, you can almost watch it grow, right? So for me, I had to realize that I wasn't buried when I went to prison. I was planted. I was planted, and I was just in need of nurturing. And I started to find my purpose as I'm counseling inmates that were going through things, and I'm really using them as case studies because I'm reading this stuff and I have to see, you know, if it's working. So I'm talking to people and they say purpose is not always something you decide, it's something you discover. You discover, and, you know, guys that I was helping kind of told me, they said, you know, man, you should do this for a living. That was helpful. I really, you know, and I was interviewing guys trying to figure out what happened, man, when you went home. And I'm taking notes. What happened? I realized some things. What happened? I said, I'm going to do the opposite of what these guys did. So I went home. I came home. I lived with my dad for the first time ever. And you know, so that was a little challenging. But my dad welcomed me with open arms. And we, you know, he was ex-military, so he liked his house a certain way. And it was perfect for me because I was at this point ready for the world. And I knew I was ready because we had a plan, and I left earlier than we had advised. And that's one sign. I always, when I train folks, I say, look, one thing about transformation, you'll know when you're ready, when it's time for you to go and they want you to stay, right? That's even with employment. That's with your living situations. When you're ready to go and they want you to stay, that means you brought value to that situation. That was significant to me because it was a sign that I'm ready. Because when I was ready to go, my dad said, why don't you stay? I like having you around, you know, and that was significant for me. So that built me some confidence. So I go off into the world and now I'm ready to, you know, work. And I was working in warehousing, really doing good in warehousing, because in prison, I developed these habits. And one thing I've learned coming home from prison is that there's many prisons out here, and not physical prisons, but proverbial prisons, prisons of habit, prisons of poverty, prisons of bad friendships, prisons of bad relationships, significant prisons. And the things I was learning was given, I said, you know, I'm going to learn how to unlock these proverbial prisons in other people. But I had nothing to gain because I'm just coming home. What did I? Who's going to believe me? So I knew that everything that I did was important in building my case that I can help others. So I got into warehouse and I became a traffic manager. I would go to work early, stay to work late, and I was really focused on building myself financially and you know, and doing those things. And so I decided, I said, you know what, now it's time for me to do some volunteer work, because I had got some success in warehousing. My dad at the time was working. He was working for a nonprofit here in Princeton called Princeton Center for Leadership Training. And so Sharon Powell from Princeton Leadership Training was really developing him. And at this time, he was clearing the path for me. And I started volunteering, talking to kids, talking to high school students, and so doing that, someone discovered me doing my talks. And it was a guy that worked for Mill Hill Center for Leadership, Mill Hill Child and Family Development Center. Steve Rosen at the time, executive director, he said, I want you on my team. So I left warehousing and the guy didn't want me to go. He said, Dre, what are you doing? You're going to Trenton to work in Trenton to help? Oh, he said, come on, Dre, you know. So I knew. I said, I must be valuable because he wanted me to stay. So I had to go. Purpose was pulling at me. And working for Mill Hill, I ended up discovering IELTS in my work. And IELTS was really working with at-risk youth. And I said, that's where I need to be, because these were young folks, 16, 17, that were really on the fence, just like I was. I said, that's where it's meant for me to be. So I met Marty Johnson, and this was back in 2001, and they wanted me to be on their team to really help these young people. And at the time, Trenton had a big gang culture, and they just knew that I was the key to really grow this program, and that's what we did. I was helping students figure it out. you know, figure out how to what I call boxing in the dark. Boxing in the dark. Because when I look at my youth and I look at, you know, my struggle, I had to empathize with their struggle. What came to play for me was, we're like, imagine you've been in this dark room and you're fighting with life. Just imagine a dark room and you're fighting with life, right? I'm talking about real dark. I'm talking about woods dark. There's no lights around. I mean, you can't see your hand from the dark, right? And life, you're in a fight with life, but they have night vision goggles. And they have an advantage at you. And you're boxing life. And you're fighting life. And life is just whooping your butt, right? And you know, so what happens is lights finally come on. And that represents knowledge. For me, when I started getting those books and I'm reading things, light switches started coming on for me. And that was, now I began to see who I was fighting. This thing called life. I was fighting the enemy. And as I was fighting, I realized that knowledge represented the fight. But I realized that as I'm fighting, the knowledge doesn't stop the fight from happening. It just now helps you see your opponent. You know who to fight. You know when to fight. Because sometimes when you're in that dark, you fight the people that's trying to help you. You know, and I realized that that's when I'm helping these young people, I saw them go through that fight. And I said, listen, man, you have to, one, learn about where you are, where you came from, and learn how to fight this fight called life. And all I am is a coach to help you get through that fight. So for years, I helped young people, and they were 16, 17, get through that fight. I've graduated students. Still to this day, I'm connected to some of those students who really internalize and embrace my counsel. But some of them didn't, you know, it didn't happen right away for them. So I had to be patient for them, like my dad was patient with me. But for years, it really panned out, because some students now are in their 40s and they'll reach out to me looking for advice. And one thing I learned, when I came home, things just didn't happen. I had to go through some struggles. I went through, my first marriage didn't work out. Right? I went through financial struggles, you know, relationship struggles, those proverbial prisons. But through the grace of God, I was able to work out those things. And I realized that it was when I was working out through those things, sometime, like Paul, I would go to God. It's like, I'm doing the right thing, man. Why is this happening? And all the while, God was fashioning me to deal with those struggles, because he knew that in order to help others, you had to be familiar with the struggle. So I realized it wasn't just coming out of prison, and I wasn't just meant to help guys coming out of prison. God was positioning me to help a whole range of people. But in order to do that, I had to answer the call. I had to understand the assignment, and the assignment was, it's not just getting out. It's not just having freedom. What are you doing with it? How do you deal with the challenges? So I went through financial troubles. And once I got out of those, I found a solution. As students came to me, as adults, and they looked for financial guidance, I was able to plug them in. As students came to me and was dealing with poor relationships, because I survived some of that, I was resilient through those relationships, I was able to help them do those things. So it was really connecting them to the things that I said, man, so God always knew. I'm going to give you one quick example of that. I came home and I was, before I got into warehousing, a lot of my friends that transitioned from the street was working on the garbage trucks, driving the garbage trucks. So I said, you know, let me go down there and check this out. So I went down there and he told me, he said, you got to go get your CDLs. You get your CDLs, come back and I'll train you. So I went to do that. I went and got my CDLs. I'm sure, you know, guys don't always answer that call. He just kind of threw me off and gave me a little homework assignment. And I went and did it, came back. And he jerked me. He didn't have the opportunity, and I was kind of left, you know. But that was a turning point for me. You know, that was a point where I could have went left, and I could have used that as an excuse to go back to the streets, but God kept me. And I said, you know what? I used that as energy to do better, and I said, I'm not letting that deter me, and I kept moving forward. And as I started to gain some success in the work I was doing, in those quiet moments, God kind of talked to me and said, see? I wanted you driving garbage trucks, you'd have been driving garbage trucks. So that was another sign of evidence. It was evidence for me, because guess what? I had students coming in and saying, Mr. Thomas, I didn't get the job, man. I'm a little distraught about it. You know, I said, when one door closes, another one can open. I said, stay steadfast to the principles that we talked about, and I guarantee doors will open for you. And I started seeing that transform, and I realized God uses people to show the evidence of what's possible, because faith is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not yet seen. But what's the evidence? The evidence of building you up from where you came from. He said, now see, I took the least likely. Because again, when you go to prison, you're pretty much, your calling card is, your destiny is pretty much, they feel like if you get 5 years and 5 years parole, they're setting you up. They said, we got a lifetime criminal here. He's going to keep coming back because it cripples you. So being able to overcome those challenges positioned me to really help a lot of people. But God wasn't done with me yet, because my dad and I for years was trying to figure out, now we want to, you know, I was helping at-risk youth, and these are youth that got in trouble. So it was more of an intervention, but something missing. And as we're searching out this purpose, God talked to us and said, what about the ninth graders? Because didn't it happen for you in the ninth grade? Where's the prevention model? Where's your prevention model? And so we had this idea, and we partnered with the Father Center to help ninth graders who were pretty good students like myself, but we realized without proper guidance, even though they're getting good grades like I was, I realized grades are not enough, because life will take those good grades and wrap them up and throw them out and attack. So we wanted to help these young folks before they got off on that track, because the school system often, when kids get good grades, they assume that they're good. Although they still lack certain social skills, they lack communication skills. This is what I discovered when we started that program in 2017, and right now it's still in effect, and we just graduated 10 of our guys, because we do cohorts of 12 every year. So we graduated 10, and these guys graduate from ninth grade, and we work with them all through high school. I have one student who in our first cohort is now at Harvard. He's Harvard, he's a Hispanic kid who, he went to PUP, real smart kid, but those life skills helped push him through. Having those additional life skills helped push him through. He's at Harvard. I have one student at the School of Institute of Technology in Rochester, New York. A lot of my students, once they graduate high school, I introduce them to programs at IELTS that I'm running in workforce development. And before I end, just to show you God's grace and God's glory, we was invited to the governor's office. I mean, the governor invited us to NORC, because all the years working at IELTS, we've always, you know, I'm doing work with LEAD, as Marshall mentioned, and our LEAD world is really helping end childhood lead poisoning. I'm in a position to train contractors. Hey, right, look, this is an ex-con who would have knew? Who would have knew that I'll be doing this, helping rebuild our communities, helping contractors get in the workforce, and some of these guys are folks from the system. Some guys are just unemployed, underemployed, and some folks are just workers that are looking to enhance skills. So I got a wide range of guys. It's not limited to just reentry. It's a whole range of guys, and helping them get on point. So the first lady gave IELTS an opportunity to create this workforce development program that will help relieve barriers to employment, like driver's license. Definitely guys coming out of the system, helping those guys get on track, really putting a workforce development model that folks can not just get a job, but sustain that job. Also connect them to the financial solutions department, because I knew that that's important. It's not about just the job, also having finances, but also coaching these guys through that process. Because I realized that, you know, when you start having successes, you know what the God means for good, the devil is going to be at work trying to pull you back in. So really helping these guys sustain that is important. But back to my ninth graders, I'm in a position to really help these guys, plug them into these workforce development options for those that are not going to college. So I really look back and I said, wow, this is beautiful. And another point of evidence, one of my ninth graders this year is one of the sons from a guy that was in my youth program when he was 16 and 17, and he was in our program, and he was a handful, but I was patient with him. I was patient with him. I used to argue for him in meetings. I'm like, I know he's a handful, but he comes every day. Let me work with him. And to this day, me and this guy, I mean, we've been connected. He's 41 years old, and he is No, I'm sorry, Dante. I'm sorry, Dante is making $41,000 a year. He's actually Dante is 33 years old. Sort of when I started IELTS, he's the age I started IELTS. And his son Dante is in my program. And he told me the other day. He said, "Mr. T, man, you're influencing generations. Cause my son, I'm so happy that you're coaching my son and helping him realize his dreams." And so I've been blessed to do that. And some when you are chasing purpose, opportunities come. Tom from the Trenton Circus Squad, who's from Princeton, came to me and said, "You know, we're teaching these kids circus skills, a lot of circus skills, but our coaches, our junior coaches, these are guys that are 20 years old, 18, 19, that have been with the squad for years. He said, they lack life skills. I need you to coach them up for life skills." At the time, I'm like, "Oh, Tom, got to talk to my wife because, you know, it's evenings, you know." So I took it on, and now I'm helping them. But guess what? Because of my work at IELTS, I'm able to connect the Trenton Circus Squad folks to opportunities at IELTS Financial Solutions, workforce development opportunities. I'm able to connect them to resources, my ninth graders, to resources. IELTS, we're helping families make homes efficient, ending childhood lead, amongst a host of other things. So when I look back, I'm like, thank you. Thank you, God. And I always reference this, and I want to close with this. So as I counsel people, and when I went through my personal challenges, because I'm telling you a story that's telling you all of the good stuff, but boy, was it a challenge going through these battles, you know, going through those finances. My wife didn't know the financial struggles I was having because I kept it from her. While helping other people, I'm working out my challenges while helping others. You know, it's sort of like a chef that's preparing meals for others, right? You barely sit down to eat yourself because you're busy preparing meals, and I'm suffering in silence, Marshall, you know. And so, you know, I had that thorn in my flesh, and you know, and oftentimes I would go to God like Paul did, and I always use Paul because, like Paul, I had the road to Damascus moment. The guy knocked me off my horse. He said, "Listen, you either gonna sell, you think you're gonna sell drugs all your life? It's not gonna happen. It will not happen. You're gonna come and help us build this community." And I was like, "Okay." "Okay, I feel you. I got you, man. I got you." So, you know, Paul said, "To keep me from becoming conceited because of these," I'm reading from Corinthians 12, Paul's vision and his thorn. "Because of these surpassingly great revelations, there has given me a thorn in my flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me. Three times I pleaded with the Lord, 'Take it away from me.' But he said to me, 'My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses so that Christ's power may rest on me." So that's so significant, because as I go through my challenges, and when students come to me or people that I'm coaching come to me with their struggles and their bad days and all of this stuff, I say, "Oh, that's great. We can do some work now." And they're like, "What are you talking about?" I said, because of that reference, I said, in our weakness, we become perfect. And it's not so much the destination, it's about the journey, the things learned. And that's my greatest message to folks. You know, as you're helping people, you know, sometimes they have to embrace their struggle, because even in the struggle, even in the darkness of a planted seed, there's development going on. But we have to fix our focus on that, because the devil will destroy us in that heat. But if we're focused and we're faithful, that heat that the devil's trying to destroy us in, God is making us stronger. It's sort of like when they stick iron into the fire, the locks, the ironsmith, he's not trying to destroy the metal. He's trying to fortify it. So sometimes we're in the fire to develop us. But if we're not connected to God and connected to the bigger picture, you will be destroyed in that fire. And that's been my message. That's my message, to stick to the script and embrace some of the challenges of life and connect with God to help give you your vision. So thank you. I wanted to leave time for
thank
questions.
Thank you, Andre Thomas. We have time for a few questions. I would like to kick it off, and then we'll get to you in
sure,
a second.
Sure.
Can you just say a little bit more about Circus Squad and what role that plays in the life of people in Trenton?
Yes, so Trenton Circus Squad is an initiative that started in Trenton, and they really bring folks from suburban settings, connecting them to kids in the urban settings, and they learn circus skills. amazing circus skills. It's out in Trenton on South Clinton Street. They do shows. Go check out their website. They're always looking for folks to come and celebrate with the kids that are learning these skills. But my job as Circus Squad is, when they tell me they can't do it, it's tough, I said, I watch you learn these skills. I can't juggle, but you can. If you all you got to do is transfer those skills. It is the things they do. I'm like, you can never tell me you can't do anything, because I see you do that. Apply that same focus to learn those skills and just apply it to life. When life gets a little tough, the same patience and focus you did to learn those skills, you can apply those to life and you'll be successful.
So there is a circus in Trenton.
There is a circus, absolutely. You got to go on the website, and it's free. It's free to the Trenton community. They learn these skills, but they do these shows. So follow the website and come out and support.
That's great. Yeah. Yes, we have a question here. Here's the microphone.
I have a friend, a guy here, grew up in Princeton. He was in Circus Squad,
yes.
So I know a lot about it.
Yes.
And we went to shows, and it was a wonderful challenge for all those kids, and they were all mixed up together, and everybody was trying. It's a great thing.
Yes, it is.
I wanted to ask you about the population that you're serving. Mm-hmm. Trenton's population has changed, or the mixture has changed as to who's living in Trenton. Could you talk about that? I know there are more Hispanic people, there are more all kinds of immigrants.
Yes.
So can you talk a bit about what is the mix in Trenton today? Because it isn't what it was.
It's a very diverse community, and it poses some challenges, because a lot of our services, you know, we try to help with translating, because, you know, we want to get into their homes and help their homes become healthier. And a lot of times those language barriers become significant. So a lot of times we have to really understand the diversity and the cultures. They're different. To engage them, you have to really recruit from those cultures, because they can translate the services better. And a lot of times the work that we're doing, it's a little intrusive. People are a little reluctant. You know, you're going into their house to look for, you know, people are a little reluctant. So it's really important to connect to the diversity. And one way that we do it at IELTS is the gardens. The community gardens really helps you connect with the different cultures, because the gardens reflect the various cultures in Trenton. Because you go to their gardens, you'll see the cultures, because they grow based on that. So it is a challenge, but connecting to the and making sure that everyone within Trenton has an opportunity at these services.
But this is an opportunity for all of these groups to learn more about each other.
Absolutely.
So that you're not just, these are the
That's
black
right.
people, and
right.
these are the, that, you know, this is an opportunity for our U.S. population to spread out and to understand other cultures, and vice versa.
That's right.
So that we have a new population.
Absolutely.
You and
have
not
to
just polarized with
That's
this
right.
and that, but a lot of a real spectrum of
people. And this is what we challenge nonprofits to do. When you're working in Trenton, you have to have diversity, equity, and inclusion. And to do that, you can't work in silos. So a lot of it is partnering with other agencies that are connected to these populations and bringing these resources together. And because a lot of these folks, they fall into these vulnerable communities. And the work that we do is across the board for vulnerable communities. It's not specific to any specific race. If you fall into an income criteria and you're vulnerable, then our services will help you. And you're right. It's all about learning about each other as well. It's really important.
Thanks, Andre, for a great
Jonathan,
presentation.
Thank you.
So just curious, so was it like 25, 30 years ago that you were inside, something like that?
Yep, okay. I came home in 97, so okay. about 25
so just
years.
What you're hearing from people coming out now compared to when you were in, so it sounds like you had an opportunity to do some peer counseling with the guys inside, and I don't know if what kind of environment is happening inside, if people feel like they have an opportunity to make some of the shifts that you were able to do,
right?
Or if there's more negative influences, or what kind of, and also when you were inside, you were saying you saw guys coming back and back and back and making the same mistakes. So I'm sure that still happens, but I don't know if you're hearing is there any change in terms of when you were into currently?
Well, you know, that's a great question. I try to keep my hands on the pulse of what's going on. So I do see a lot of folks across the country, like just one guy, I forget his name, Andre Ward. I forget his last name, but his name is Andre, so I remember him. But there's a lot of folks coming out that are successful giving back and going in, like Tracy Side Effects, you know. And so there could be, I'm sure there could be more going in and really helping these guys while they're in prison, having interventions. I think it's important to really engage them while they're in, to connect them to resources once they come out. It really takes a team of resources to really help these guys. And getting time to go in was great. I remember years ago, I used to go into Trenton State Prison with an IELTS board member, you know, helping folks. But these guys were actually lifers that know they weren't coming out, and they just wanted to help our youth. It was like a deterrence, you know, and it wasn't scared straight. They really talked intimate to these guys to really, really deter them from coming in. But it is a challenge, because getting in to DOC is a challenge, but it's a need to really get in there to engage them on that level. But I'm not sure how widespread it is or how rampant it is, but I know there's a big need to get in there and start coaching them before they come out to see me. But I have worked with halfway houses to connect with them once they come out. But I know the prison structure has changed. I know when I talk to guys, it's much different from when I was in. It had its own challenges, but, you know, challenges over time changes, you know, with the gang culture. I'm sure that, you know, if I ever had to go back, it would probably be much different, you know. But one thing I've learned with people, they're resilient and they adapt and they adjust. But the thing is really trying to figure out what was their struggle and really come where they are and really get into what some of their struggles were to really coach them up. So, yeah, it's definitely a challenge, in and out. Yes, ma'am.
Women, are you working with women?
Well, I do. Now,
are you working with women?
Our youth program is specific for young boys, but in the work at IELTS, it's, you know, I have a lot of women contractors who are really good at what they do. Matter of fact, I just trained up a whole team of a contractor who is a woman, and she has a whole team of guys, you know, and she's statewide too. So she sends folks to get trained, but she's a woman, and that's a great example. We'd like to work with them because there's a lot of advantage for women and minorities in the construction field. So we're always looking to get more women involved. Matter of fact, one of the weatherization companies, CMC, is ran by a woman, and CMC has grown nationally. So that, you know, so yeah, we do have a presence in that field particular. Yep.
Well, first, thank you so much.
Thank you.
But my question, as a community of faith, how could we help you?
You know, sort of with Jonathan, figuring out how we can get into the prisons to help, getting involved with programs that are helping folks that are coming out, the halfway houses. Is really good. And it's really like any reentry program. They got a reentry program called Work Well in Trenton. So just connecting, mentoring is always good. And like I said, me, I'm a tough mentor. I'm a tough coach, you know. And we all are coaches in our own right, because a coach speaks on their experiences. And our experiences come from various places. So you guys are important because you come from a different experience. And I think that's important for them to see the various, you know. I always tell guys, you have to build your network. You know, with guys like Bill and Jonathan out here and Marshall, you got to connect with these guys because they have opportunities. So, yeah, just being in a position to help mentor, coach these guys, and connect them to opportunities. Use your resources to help them. And I always tell guys when they come into our trainings, you know, build your network. I said, now you're a part of my network. But I said, it's so important to have a support system and connecting with folks that can really help clear that path for you. But I always tell this. You still got to put the work in. There's no free lunch. And in the building of success, you have to take the stairs. There's no elevator. You got to take the stairs. So holding them accountable is important, because they will try to, you know, run circles around you. So holding them accountable and staying firm but fair. But firm, you know, you have to look for folks that are not really totally bought into this thing called transformation, but you use your discerning eye to see if they're really serious about it. You have to use discernment and connect with guys like me to help give you some insights on whether this guy is really serious or he's just trying to run game. So you always got to discern those things as well. It's important, you know. And a lot of times when they're running game, it's not that they're really just, it's just that this is what they learned to survive, and, you know, they can't help it sometimes. So you just got to, you know, you got to be firm. Listen, don't try to play me. Right.
Thank you, Andre Thomas.
Well, thank
That's
you.
All the time we have.
All right, thank you.
We will wrap up our series on Bending the Moral Arc Toward Justice in the season of Juneteenth next week with Nafisa Goldsmith, who will talk to us about education in the time of technology for underserved populations. We hope you'll join us. Thank you.